From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a new interview with the author Jennifer Egan, whose new novel is The Candy House, published by Scribner. Jennifer Egan is the author of six previous books of fiction: Manhattan Beach, winner of the Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Fiction, a book about which I spoke to Jennifer in 2017, and then A Visit from the Goon Squad, which won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award, The Keep, the story collection Emerald City, Look at Me, a National Book Award finalist, and The Invisible Circus. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, Harper's Magazine, Granta, McSweeney's, and the New York Times Magazine. Here's a little information about The Candy House, which shares a fictional world and a number of characters with Egan's earlier book, A Visit from the Goon Squad. The book opens with the staggeringly brilliant Bix Boughton, whose company, Mandala, is so successful that he is, quote, one of those tech demigods with whom we're all on a first-name basis. Bix is 40, with four kids, restless and desperate for a new idea, when he stumbles into a conversation group, mostly Columbia professors, one of whom is experimenting with downloading or externalizing memory. Within a decade, Bix's new technology, Own Your Unconscious, which allows you to access every memory you've ever had and to share your memories in exchange for access to the memories of others, has seduced multitudes. My interview with Jennifer Egan begins with me asking my first question. I hope you enjoy our conversation. You opened the book with Bix craving just to talk, which was so wonderful as I got into the book and realized that that was kind of an ironic way to begin. He's craving just to talk, and he has created a world that makes it harder and harder to get that. But later, from the point of view of a character named Miles, do you mind if I just read a sentence?
Not at all.
So Miles reflects, "If my life has taught me anything, it's that curiosity and expediency have a sneaky, inexorable power. Resisting them is easy for a minute, 100 minutes, even a year, but not forever." And this is also about craving. And you weave it all so nicely together, cravings and the need to be accepted and loved and the need to be relevant or important, and the way social media has sort of led us to lie to ourselves about what we crave. Anyway, it's a lot to have written about and to talk about, but I thought we would start there, and I wondered if you have any thoughts just about what I just said.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. For example, where the book begins, in a way, was very spontaneous and kind of impulsive, which is so much of how I end up generating my material. Mm-hmm. You know, I really... there's not a lot of plan. I mean, in fact, there's no planning before I start the writing process. And so that chapter about Bix, I actually wrote back in, I think, 2012. And I should mention, if you're interested, I keep forgetting to mention this, but on my website, you can look at the first page of every chapter as published. And if you hover over the first paragraph, it dissipates and you're looking at a marked up first draft.
Oh, cool.
In type. And then if you hover there, you get back to my handwritten first draft. And sometimes even drafts below that, that kind of didn't go anywhere, but ultimately led to that chapter. And I think that I started with wanting to talk like in 2012 or maybe even 2011. I can't remember when I actually began that Bix chapter, but so it's really hard to remember. I mean, I think it's fair to say I wasn't thinking of much of anything. I just was starting with, you know, a married couple in bed, a baby, New York, affluence and restlessness. Those were sort of the vibes that I had. And in a way, because of the way I generate material, it's much more a process of me following the crumbs of what appears into whatever vision they seem to lead to, rather than starting with a vision and then carefully placing clues and crumbs all over the place for the reader. So I guess what I'm really saying is that while I ultimately take ownership of a lot of what I see there and get rid of a lot of terrible writing and sort of lame ideas, the big picture is something that sometimes is interesting for me to discover too, but it feels more like a discovery than me making a point through fiction.
Okay.
And so I guess I can talk about some of the ideas that I had leading into it, but I think what I wasn't thinking, I want to write a book that shows how social media thwarts the very impulses that it purports to satisfy, but you could certainly see it as that. I mean, Bix wants to talk. He wants connection. He wants more. He basically wants his own memory to function, to be searchable in the way that the social media ecosystem that he has largely helped to create in my fictional world allows people to find each other so easily. So he's sort of holding internal life to the same standard that the internet meets. And, you know, we kind of see this all over the place.
Right.
I mean, the internet creates all kinds of expectations, one of which is that everything should be free, which has been unbelievably problematic to so many industries.
Right.
And in a way, it's no surprise. You know, we humans are so habitual. We get into the habit of getting everything for free. We get in the habit of instant gratification. I want to know this. Boom. Where's the answer?
Yes.
So I guess rather than sort of thinking about what points I wanted to make, I started very much with Bix dealing with his frustration at not being able to satisfy his own wishes, created largely by his own technology, that his memory will be complete and will unscroll like a video and show him everything, when that's not really how memory works. And the other thing I should just mention is that what Bix would invent, this own your unconscious device, really didn't come into focus for me until very late in the process. Okay. When I wrote that first chapter, I knew that he would invent something and that it would be important. I didn't know how important it would be. And I didn't necessarily know that that would be the first chapter when I was writing it. Bix was one of the characters that when I finished Goon Squad, I was most interested in writing about, because I felt like I knew something about him that the reader didn't know, because I knew when I wrote the scene in Goon Squad where he basically predicts the effects of social media that he would invent it. And so I felt like that was just an obvious place to go for me, not toward, you know, his first invention, because that seems sort of boring, but toward the lull that might occur when he's trying to figure out what to do next.
Right, right. There's this great scene. And actually, I wanted to ask you about that. There's this great moment early on. There's a character named Cyril. And Cyril says, "How many seminal theories can one scholar produce in a lifetime?" "Indeed," Bix murmured, and felt the stirring of a familiar dread. And I'm from the perspective of writing, I thought that that was a great thing to talk about, because it, you know, we're always told to kind of state our characters' desires and obstacles. And I felt like right there, boom, you've got Bix's desires and obstacles just in that exchange.
That's so funny. I've never heard that dictum, state your character's desires and obstacles, but I can see how that would be a useful pointer.
Right. I'm not sure it's a specific way people word it, but yeah, I mean, I think that's something. And it just struck me when I read that you were right there. We knew exactly what Bix wants and what's not happening for him in that moment in time, which was kind of great. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I guess the other thing, again, where I come to it from, not so much ideas about social media, but identification with Bix and following the logic of his personality, history, and impulses into a possible future for him. So, you know, when I think about him, I feel so much sympathy, because I know that feeling too, of having done something that you've been vastly rewarded for, and wondering if, not only suspecting you don't deserve it and wanting to prove that you did by somehow topping it and being unable to, or really frozen, especially with that kind of pressure, psychological pressure. So, you know, while his life is very far from mine, I mean, he's obviously, you know, he's sort of one of those tech icons that we read about in the newspaper, but his plight felt extremely immediate to me. And that's really where I came from was just following. Jane Smiley used a phrase that I absolutely loved when I heard her speak once, which was the energy of logic. The energy of logic is so recognizable to me because it, I feel like that is what I'm following in a kind of improvisational way. I've never done improv on, I've never even acted, and I don't play an instrument. So I'm not familiar with improv as a performer, but when I witness it or am present listening to it, it feels to me very much like what I'm doing single-handedly with my first drafts. And I should immediately add that there is a lot of analytical thinking and planning and outlining that comes in later.
Right.
But what I'm looking for is just a line of action or logic that feels alive, that has some sort of pulse, and then just pushing into that with everything I've got. Right. And that's sort of where I get my material. So it's not that I don't go, that I don't think intellectually, because I do. And it, and I'm always keeping lists of issues and questions that preoccupy me. Mm-hmm. But once I start writing, I'm not thinking about that stuff. What I find though, is because I spend so much of my regular life thinking about it and making lists of, you know, things, formal things I want to try, cultural preoccupations and even philosophical preoccupations, that stuff tends to sort of, leach into the work. Thank God.
Yeah, no. Well, it's interesting because you said that, about not being like Bix, but I actually have a question here. It struck me that like Bix and like Lou, you have a certain kind of fame. Early in the book, Bix reflects on the delight of anonymity. And it seems like some of your more famous characters, like Bix and Lou, seem mostly not to enjoy fame. And neither of them is an actor. Neither of them is necessarily immediately recognizable to everyone, although perhaps Bix more because he is like this icon of social media. But I just wondered how it is for you when you are recognized. Is that weird? Do you not like that? Do you like that?
You know, it's so rare that it happens. I mean, I feel very lucky because writing is an invisible profession.
Right.
And so writers are just never famous in that way. I think maybe at an earlier point they were, when books had more cultural power, and writers had these sort of, you know, almost always male,
right,
these sort of
12 white guys
personas. Exactly. I have no sorrow that that's, I mean, I wish books had more cultural power for all kinds of reasons, but speaking personally, I love that, I don't like move through my life feeling famous at all, because that to me, fame creates a distance between the person and the world, and that I need that distance to disappear. So it would be a lot of constant work for me to be removing that distance. When I do encounter people who know me, who know who I am, they're always readers,
right,
and therefore they're my people.
Right.
So I'm like so happy to meet another reader in the world, someone who cares about fiction enough to recognize a writer, that it's like, I feel like we would know each other anyway. Oh, and so it's so nice to meet.
Yeah, that's great. The place that this book went, for me anyway, that I thought was so inspiring was to go to authenticity, the quest for authenticity. And you have a character named Alfred. Is it Alfred?
Yep.
Who's really, really focused on finding authenticity to the point that it's just like, oh my goodness.
Yeah, I have to say, Alfred, I've never laughed out loud more about a character. And the funny thing is, it actually took a really long time to make that chapter work. It's not like that was a slam dunk at all, because, you know, in the end, it only really worked as this kind of case study, couched in a kind of idiosyncratic academic voice, because so I guess what I'm saying is, it's not like everything was on fire writing about Alfred. And maybe the problem was I was so tickled by the thought of Alfred. And I kept laughing, even imagining him with the bag over his head before I'd even gotten to the screaming. I could hardly talk about it. Like, I remember describing it to my mother, which is rare for me because I normally don't really talk specifically about what I'm writing about, but I was so enamored of this idea that I just couldn't repress it. And I spoke to my mother about it and I was laughing so hard, I couldn't even get the words out. And it was clear to me that, I mean, she thought it was funny too, but in no way was she, you know, moved to hysteria, which is kind of where I was heading. Right. So I don't know what on earth it was about Alfred that I found to be so much fun. But I will say that having that strong a reaction and that much of a preference for a character makes it harder for me to write about that person, for sure. But the authenticity is a topic that I actually, this is an example of the kind of intellectual conundrum that I think about very consciously. And it's worth mentioning that I read a book years ago that had a huge impact on me, but sadly it reads as very outdated now. So for example, I assigned it to my undergrads in a literature lecture course. I was teaching at Penn in 2019, and I actually removed it from the syllabus and ultimately just gave them a chapter and then lectured about it. It was published in 1961. It's called The Image by Andrew Boorstin. Is it Andrew? It's so weird that I'm forgetting that. I think so. But Boorstin. Okay. And he's, so 1961. So he's writing about image culture as he witnessed it in the 1950s. So he's really talking about television, which obviously was a cataclysmic new invention. And the reason it's outdated is that his examples are all from the 1950s, which even I don't recognize, much less students now. But also, this is what I didn't realize the last time I had reread it, which was maybe 10 or 15 years ago. It's written in a very paternalistic, Christian, and ultimately very, very, very sexist, verging on misogynistic in his dismissal of women and trivializing of women. So it's just, it doesn't work anymore, but the points that he makes are excellent and they hold true to every iteration of internet experience I've been exposed to this day. And that's luckily so I have, you know, I had my kids late, so I have some access to this world that I wouldn't otherwise. Anyway, one of the things that he talks about is how mediated experience is inherently artificial. You're trying to create a semblance of naturalness around an event that is essentially staged. And that artificiality creates a hunger for authenticity in the viewer. And media culture then tries to satisfy that hunger for authenticity through ever greater feats of mediation. That's the gist of sort of one strand of his argument. It is rock solid.
Yeah.
You know, right through a couple of weeks ago when one of my 19-year-old son was telling me about a new app he has called Be Real. And the idea is that at a particular time of day with no warning, the app says now, and everyone has to take a picture of themselves and whoever they're with, their sort of their surroundings. No time for curation, no time for lighting, just boom.
And you don't know when that will be.
Exactly. Yeah. And the whole idea is you're seeing their real selves. Well, I was ecstatic when he told me about this, even though I was unhappy with the subway lighting when he shot my picture to be part of me.
That's perfect.
But it's, you know, it's just so that idea. And I first read this book in the 90s when Boorstin was still alive. And he was a historian who wrote many other books, too. Very conservative, interestingly. But I just, for me, and there are other thinkers who were also writing about this. There's Guy Debord, a Frenchman who wrote a book called The Society of the Spectacle, which makes some of the same points. But for me, Boorstin really, Daniel Boorstin, that's his first name. Daniel, Boorstin's book distilled it in the most succinct and clear way. And I've just been thinking about it ever since. And the impact of image culture and its resulting appetites for authenticity has been a pretty overt subject in everything I've done, I would say, really all of my books. And it just, you know, I guess I really let it rip with
well, the thing I should, Alfred. The thing we should share about Alfred is that he does almost like performance art to get attention and authentic reactions from people. And it's really fun. Like you said, he puts a bag over his head and eats through a mouth hole just to see what his family's reaction will be. And he screams spontaneously in public situations just to get authentic reactions from the people around him. So it's really fun. But do you mind if I read just one thing?
No, please.
So Trudy was an avid Facebook poster, a touter of family vacations and toddler artworks, a coiner of sappy hashtags like hashtag mother-daughter love and hashtag thank goodness for grandparents that Alfred logged onto Facebook specifically to be enraged by. I love that so much.
Well, you know, it's funny because what that gets at is, you know, as you say, so Alfred is allergic to what he sees as artificiality, but he is also drawn to that allergy. He goes looking for it. And in a way, what it does is justify these extreme forms of behavior that he cultivates to generate authentic reactions, which, as you say, culminates in a practice that he calls a project, the screaming project. And that involves spontaneously screaming bloody murder in a variety of contexts to witness people's reactions. And of course, the reactions are very negative. People are terrified. They try to flee. And then at a certain point, when they realize there's nothing wrong, they become enraged.
Right.
And for Alfred, this is just so dazzling. I mean, he at one point he likens it to the express, or early in a screaming episode, he likens the faces around him to the faces of people in a plane plunging toward the sea. But what he consoles himself, he sort of justifies all of this with the fact that he's not actually hurting anyone. He's generating emotional responses and soaking them up in a way that you could probably argue has become kind of an addiction for him. He gets a kind of high from it.
Definitely.
But he leaves people unscathed, he tells himself. But of course, you know, this is not a sustainable way of living. And we, in fact, in one chapter of the book, witness Alfred's last screaming episode, where things go awry in a way that really makes it impossible for him to continue. But I did enjoy very much the humor of writing about him and a lot of other people. There's a lot of absurdity in this book, which I think may result from the improvisational method, because if the goal is to find a line of action and sort of lean into it as hard as I can, often where that lands me is at a point of kind of, it's logical. I got there through logic, but it's ridiculous at the same time. And what I find is that that's often where humor lives.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of fun. And maybe, you know, pulling a lot of this book together during the pandemic, I guess I felt like I really needed some laughs, and I hope that the reader will appreciate those.
But it's interesting that you got to your own amusement with the idea of Alfred before you found a way to convey it really well on the page. That's really interesting, you know, and I like that. I like that you worked through it and definitely got there. So.
Well, that's the thing, you know, improv, at least for me, only gets me so far. What it can do is generate material that I probably couldn't have thought of otherwise. But then it's my job to craft that into something that really has organic stability, that really works as a book and is more than just a laugh. And that's I think it's fair to say that's the hardest part, actually. Mm-hmm. Because the generation is very spontaneous. Improv is spontaneous. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but it happens in a somewhat effortless fashion, or at least not a very cerebral way.
Yeah.
And then I have to take control of it.
I wanted to talk to you about a character named Drew, and Drew was in a visit from the Goon Squad. I keep calling it Goon Squad, and then I forget the full name.
I call it that, too.
Yeah. So Drew engages in the collective unconscious or collective consciousness and watches Bix's memories of the drowning of a mutual friend of theirs. I think the memory doesn't show the drowning. It shows Drew himself and Rob, another friend, interacting with Bix right before they went swimming, and Rob ended up drowning. And so he's watching this memory, and he wants to stop the memory. He wants to shout to his younger self and tell himself to go back and tell Rob to go back and not get in the water. And it was very emotional reading that, actually, because that's, of course, something that would happen. People would perseverate on these painful memories if they were available to watch over and over. But it also made me wonder, and this maybe seems like a little bit of a trivial question, but I wondered if, as the author, you ever have a reaction to that, to putting your characters through difficult and painful situations. Is it hard? Or do you sort of not go there with
you know, that? Well, I'm sort of, I'm a little ashamed to admit this, but honestly, if I feel like there's heat on the page, I am only happy.
Okay.
I'll put anyone through anything to get to, because for me, the novel is a place, fiction generally, is where we go to feel.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true on the most immediate sensory level, like, that when we're reading fiction, we are inside another brain and body perceiving the world. And a lot of what we perceive in any moment is the physical environment around us. So there's a lot of feeling that should be happening. And then there's the emotional response. And finding my way to an emotional response that's complex and powerful is the beginning and the end of the job, really. Mm-hmm. So if I've managed to do that, I am delighted.
Okay. That's
I don't care who has to go under the bus. Not to sound too callous.
No.
But yes, I mean, that I was very happy with that scene because it felt right to me, you know, as you say. So, you know, Bix's move to invent the machine because he stands in the place where he stood with Rob and Drew back in 1993 and tries to remember what ended up being a really crucial morning. Because as you say, the two younger boys walk down the river and Bix never sees again. They've had a night of partying. They're watching the sunrise. These are all NYU students. But all those years later, Bix cannot remember really much of anything about that morning. And he is so frustrated that it's what moves him to invent Own Your Unconscious, that which lets people externalize their memories so they can view them in full from a present day perspective. When he lets Drew know about this invention, and he gets back in touch with Drew, lets him know about the invention, and Drew comes to, you know, experience it, of course, they go back to that same morning, which felt right to me because I feel like that's so much what trauma does to all of us. Mm-hmm. We return to the scene. That's why trauma is so devastating, because it keeps pulling us back with the hope, the vain hope of changing the outcome. And in a way, analogously to what you described earlier about social media sort of pulling us apart, even as it offers to bring us closer together, this more complete memory, this, you know, basically solid film-like unfurling of Bix's memory, offers that promise of changing the outcome even more fully than our own fragmented memories do. So Drew puts on the headset, watches himself and Rob through Bix's eyes,
right,
and he's screaming because all he wants is for the outcome to be different, and this can't change it. So it felt like I was glad that it brought all of the pieces in to bear on a dramatic moment. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm always trying to do. And my pleasure over that completely outweighed my pity for Drew.
Well, I have another emotional moment I loved with Drew, and I don't do spoilers on the show, so we're not going to talk about what ultimately happens. And actually, what ultimately happens isn't the point of my question. But at another point, Drew decides that he is needed or wanted on a hot air balloon ride that the character Miles is going on. And Drew doesn't have time to really do it, but he makes a snap decision to kind of to hell with his schedule. He's going to go. The thing that I wanted to ask you about is you write his entry into the balloon very, he's like very awkward. He kind of spills into the balloon. And it perfectly mirrors the reactions of the other two people on the balloon, which are, what are you doing? I mean, they didn't need him or want him at all. And I loved that. I wondered if you recalled writing that and, you know, physically presenting his clumsiness in a way that would sort of mirror so much about the moment.
This is a good question because I wrote that scene much more recently. That chapter I actually wrote during the pandemic. In fact, I was working on that scene while I had COVID as part of the March 2020 New York wave. Wow. So I was quarantined and listening to sirens and writing that scene. I wonder if that's partly why that scene went the way it did. Anyway, the part you describe I do remember writing it, and it's exactly the way that when improv works, it goes. Because what I have is two characters who want very different things. Mm-hmm. We've got Miles, who has blown up his life through a prescription drug addiction, very much a marginal figure, who's come to visit his cousin Sasha and see her artwork, these sculptures she's making in the desert, in the hopes of something, in the hopes of finding out how she made her life work, whereas his life, which was all set up to be perfect, doesn't seem to have worked at all. Then you have Drew, who is this man who's, I think it's fair to say, really haunted by this death that he was adjacent to back when he was an undergrad, the death of Rob by drowning, who perhaps because of that, in part, feels that, and also he's a doctor, by the way, feels this kind of nagging responsibility for Miles, but also really resents it. It's like this guy has come out of nowhere and suddenly he seems to need to be taken care of. It's really irritating.
Right. And we should say Drew is Sasha's husband. So he's stuck with him in his house. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And Sasha and Miles, who never liked each other, have nothing to say to each other. So somehow Drew seems to be the one who's on call to manage this marginal guy who suddenly dropped on their doorsteps and they haven't seen him in 15 years. So in a way, there's something kind of comic about the very setup. And then I just thought, well, let's see what happens. And I remember writing through that morning where Drew wants to get away, but can't pull himself away. And Miles just wants to get up in this balloon for reasons he's not clear on. And it's a sort of collision between the two of them, really. And that you know, ludicrous lurching of Drew into the balloon, which Miles doesn't even want him to do, just seemed to capture the whole thing. So that's exactly what I'm trying to get to with the improvisational handwriting first draft.
Yeah. No, it was really, and it's fun now that you say how Drew feels very much responsible for people and he feels like he needs to make sure everything's going to be okay. So that was another level or another layer of it that I didn't even think about, but I thought that was great.
I'm going to mention one more thing, which is another principle that I have a lot as I'm working. And I think at this point, it's just an impulse more than an idea, is once I've established anything, I want to either move on to something else or work against what I've established.
Oh, interesting.
So that's just a sort of rhythmic methodology that whose goal is to bring as much onto the page as possible. So, you know, if Drew and Miles are basically on a collision course and somewhat hating each other by the time they get into this balloon, the only thing you, the reader, know, and the only thing I knew as I was writing is that can't continue. Something has to happen that is not only going to sort of defy that, but possibly turn it on its head. Mm-hmm. That's just going to happen, because one thing I'm not going to do is just keep doing what I've done. If I've done my job, I shouldn't need to keep doing it. It's time to either do something entirely different or actually reverse what I've done, push against it so that we can find out what happens when it is undermined by subsequent action.
Uh-huh. That's really interesting. That's great. I mean, I can see that about your work, because you clearly love changing narrators. You clearly love changing presentation. Your presentation is so interesting. You know, you have like Lincoln, who woos this woman using math, which holds its own kind of lovely contradiction. And then there's Lulu the Spy 2032, which is presented as a series of aphorisms in two columns. I'm not going to go too heavily into detail about what's happening in these things. And then later, another chapter involving Lulu is presented in email. So like you obviously really love being very creative with your presentation and your narrators. But I hadn't thought before how you kind of push back against things as you're getting into them.
Well, one thing I would say about using kind of, I guess what I would call unusual structures, like as you say, Lulu the Spy was actually written for Twitter at 140 characters mm-hmm. and was tweeted by The New Yorker in 2012. And yes, there's an epistolary chapter, although there's nothing new about that, of course.
No, there's not.
A lot of the early novels were very epistolary. But what I love about using those forms, interestingly, is not just that they add variety to these ensemble books. And not all of my books are like this, that's for sure. But A Visit from the Goon Squad and The Candy House are both books that work through a kind of kaleidoscopic effect where we have multiple points of view, we're inside multiple consciousnesses, and those stories are told in ways that feel very different from each other in terms of atmosphere and texture, because each of us is our own universe. We perceive the world very differently. And if one sensibility is guiding all of these different points of view, it doesn't feel to me like I'm really presenting different points of view. It feels like I'm I'm homogenizing different points of view into one narrative voice. That's fine too. And there are wonderful books written that way, but that's not how these books work. To me, the kaleidoscopic effect is more powerful if we feel the granular differences among these points of view. So what using, maybe you could say, sort of radical structures lets me do is tell stories that I could never tell otherwise, because an unusual any structure only works if there is no other way I could have told the story I'm telling. In other words, in Lulu the Spy, for example, in 2032, Lulu, a character we have met in A Visit from the Goon Squad as a child and a young adult, and then we meet her again as a child in The Candy House as a kind of peripheral external character. Now suddenly we're in her mind, she's in her 30s, and she's working for the US government, infiltrating a group of men who are believed to be destroying it or trying to destroy it. And narrating the steps of her mission in a form of lessons. And what that form let me do was tell a fairly standard genre-esque spy story, honestly, in a way that feels different and feels more interior. And in fact, Lulu is narrating these lessons through a device implanted in her brain. So it is literally interior. But if you think about what Lulu the Spy, that chapter, would read like if it were just told conventionally, it would be silly. It would be dull, honestly, because it's a story we've all heard before. But the fun of it is telling it in this way.
Okay. All right. I wanted to ask, since I've just mentioned Lincoln, sorry, Lincoln, using math to woo a woman he's in love with. Did you want his data to be based on real data? Did you care about the math? Did you have to like spend a lot of time getting ready to write that? Or were you able to kind of go like, oh, there's a suspension of disbelief here that I'm going to lean on a little bit?
Well, I'm glad you asked about that chapter because it's a very unique, well, it's one extreme for me. So that's another one I wrote very early, back, I think, in 2012 or so. I would have to look at my own website to confirm that because my first drafts are always dated. But anyway, a while ago. And when I wrote it, I actually bought various books about data studies and data, you know, the data economy or whatever. I never opened any of them.
Okay.
we know a little bit about Lincoln, if you've read A Visit from the Goon Squad, because he makes an appearance as a somewhat troubled teen who's driving everyone crazy by analyzing and measuring the lengths of pauses in rock and roll songs. And I knew when I wrote about him then, I thought, okay, Lincoln is kind of a mess. What happens to Lincoln? He was an obvious person to follow into his future. So we meet him in the candy house as a young adult, succeeding, you know, very much in the world of data collection, which now includes, we begin to sense, collection of data from people's thoughts, which exist in this collective consciousness that has resulted from Bix Boughton's invention. I wrote that chapter in a kind of rushing frenzy. And every mathematical principle I invoke is completely made up.
Okay.
Because I never opened one of those books and I never got past trigonometry, where I had a teacher named Mr. Nickerson at my big public high school in San Francisco, whose volume problems all involved vodka as the substance. And you can maybe guess from that how good a teacher Mr. Nickerson was. Suffice it to say that I barely got through it and never took another math class, although I had liked math before. So it is bizarre that I ended up writing this chapter that feels really deeply motivated by a quantitative point of view. So I wrote that chapter and then I thought it sort of didn't work. I put it away along with a lot of other first draft material. And I didn't pull any of this stuff out again until 2016. And it was still handwritten. I had not even typed it up. When I typed up that chapter about Lincoln, which at that point I think was called Solve for X, I felt like someone else had written it. It was very hard for me to even connect to the point of view I inhabited to write that chapter. And it is in my entire career, I'm 59 years old, it is the chapter that I have had to do the fewest drafts of from beginning to end. Uh-huh. I think it's only 8, which is unheard of for me to go from that improvisational stage to completion in 8 drafts. I mean, that's, as a point of comparison, I have gone up to 70 drafts on a single chapter.
And when you say that, what do you mean? Are you rewriting from scratch, or are you adjusting and changing, or all of the above?
So that's an interesting point, because since I tend to edit by hand on hard copies, and then I number my drafts, I tally up what seem to be very large numbers of drafts. But if you think about numbering each pass through a document, through a, you know, a Word document, let's say, as a separate draft, you would also start to reach high numbers pretty quickly. So it just means, literally, in my case, I marked something up and I typed in changes and spewed out a new iteration. Gotcha. Sometimes there aren't that many changes toward the end, but at the beginning, there's radical tearing apart, putting back together, restructuring, adding new material. Again, because what I'm starting with is this very raw kind of improvisational stuff. But with the Lincoln chapter, it was almost as it turned out to be from the beginning.
That's great.
Which all goes to say that, you know, there's just so much more in all of us than we know. And of course, that's exactly what Own Your Unconscious, the so-called device that Bix invents, is motivated by. This idea of taking ownership of all that we have in us. That's kind of what I do when I write fiction. Because I don't know what's there. And what I know is there is in no way sufficient to do the work that I end up doing.
Yeah. Is that true for a novel like Manhattan Beach, or a novel like The Keep, as well as these sort of more technologically dependent novels, would you say?
100%.
Yeah.
In fact, I've never written a worse first draft than I did for The Keep. Oh. In fact, my working title was A Short Bad Novel. Because I thought, there's no way I can disappoint. If I just write a short bad novel, I will have fulfilled my title. And I did not exceed expectations. No. And actually, The Keep is an interesting example because it's a gothic thriller,
right?
Which is very if you read it now, it reads as pretty intricately plotted with some pretty big twists. I had to discover those twists. Mm-hmm. And I think one reason that the first draft was so terrible is that it's very hard to do that improvisationally. So what I had was a really lurching mess. And then it was only when I sort of looked carefully at what was there and thought about it that I saw how I could really turn it into a device that would work on the level of a thriller.
Okay. I always like to ask my guests what they've read lately that they might recommend. We've already got The Image by Boorstin, along with caveats. But what have you read lately that you might recommend to people who love to read?
Well, I'm always reading old stuff, so I don't know whether that interests you.
That's great.
I'll recommend a couple of new books first. A story collection called The Partition by Don Lee, a Korean-American writer who has been writing it with tremendous nuance and skill about being Korean-American in some sense, although his work has tons of variety in it, since 2001, when he published his first collection, Yellow. And The Partition is really spectacular, so I recommend that. It's a story collection. And then another is a book called Run and Hide by Pankaj Mishra, who's better known for his nonfiction. But this is an amazing novel, really looking at it's about three guys who meet in college in India at the beginning of the sort of tech burst in India and the sort of so-called new India that it was supposed to usher in, and what happens to them. And it's really, really great.
Okay.
So those are two things that I've read recently that I really liked. Let's see. And then older stuff. I mean, let's see. I just read for the first time The Pickwick Papers.
Oh, really?
By Dickens, which is a lot of fun and actually very interesting. You know, it's very episodic and kind of, you know, these serialized books, you can feel there really is padding sometimes where you can just feel Dickens like, oh my God, how can I close out this episode?
It's so Tuesday. This is due tomorrow.
Yeah. And so in some ways, these books don't meet our standards of compression nowadays. But what it really ends up being is a kind of fascinating love story about Mr. Pickwick, a bachelor, and his servant, his manservant, who is Sam Weller, who ends up married but Sam Weller is the most interesting character in the book for sure. So it just becomes it's an interesting meditation of its time, of course, in which there was a servant class, and you know, there's no getting around that. And if you're offended by that stuff, it's not going to be a book that will be pleasant to read, but I'm always much more interested in using novels as basically time machines to understand all of the forces at work and the mores, the unwritten rules around behavior, especially governing female sexuality that existed in a particular moment. And that's one reason I'm always reading backwards. I recently read, a tall order, but I'm going to throw it out there. I recently read Clarissa by Samuel Richardson, which is an 18th century novel.
Wow.
Which is written, it's all epistolary. So it's all in letters. It's the longest novel written in English, even longer than David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest. It's too long. I'm going to just say that right up front. An abridged version would be fine, but it's just a masterpiece. It's a searing and brutal indictment of a culture that treats women as property. And it pushes the injustice of that fact to its absolute limit. It's completely unflinching and brutal. Mm-hmm. I thought it was just incredible. So I'm always reading backward and also reading contemporary work.
Okay. What about writing? What are you writing next? Or do you know? It sounds like you write multiple things at one time, maybe, or not?
I can work on two first drafts at once, because in that improvisational phase, I tend to write very fast. Yeah. Because that's a way of making sure that I don't start thinking and I just keep writing. In a way, also, again, back to theatrical improv, you don't have people standing around thinking about what to do next. You have to just keep going. So in that early phase, I can work on more than one thing. And in fact, I wrote Manhattan Beach and The Candy House for a couple of years, both.
Wow.
But then I just gave myself completely to Manhattan Beach, which required a lot of research. I'm really interested in 1950s detective fiction.
Okay.
So I'm sort of thinking about that and working on that, but I don't know. I have some big questions about whether what the direction I've gone is really going to lead anywhere. It feels like it might be a dead end, which can really happen using my methodology. There's not always gold at the end of the rainbow, sadly.
How long do you give yourself to find the gold?
Well, in this case, I have about 150, 200 pages handwritten. And I feel like it's a little like a solitaire game where there's just no new card to turn over. So what I'm going to do, I'm now typing it up. And I think if I read it typed, I'll have a much better sense. You know, with the Lincoln chapter that you mentioned, rhyme scheme, I thought that didn't work and put it aside. But when I typed it up and read it, I thought, I couldn't even quite figure out why I thought that. So sometimes I just need to look at things differently. And one nice thing about handwriting is that it gives me all kinds of different moments where I can see things in new ways. One is after it's typed. And then at various different iterations thereafter, but it's helpful to go from handwriting to type. So we'll see about that. And then I'm very interested in writing another all-out historical novel set in New York in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. Very interested in the 19th century, not just because there's so much, I mean, it was sort of the great era of fiction in terms of its cultural power, but really a couple of other reasons. One is it's when the physical plant of New York was built as we know it, and Row House New York, which is fast disappearing, I might add, and therefore all the more interesting to me. But also I'm interested in the 19th century before a lot of the inventions that we take for granted came along. So, you know, a lot of the things that we think of as 20th century inventions were not. The telephone, electricity, film, recorded music, all of that came along in the late 19th century and actually became very common. I'm interested in the moment before that.
Okay.
So we'll see. We'll see.
All right. Great. I always end these interviews with a question about advice for writers, because the show is really for writers as well as curious readers. So I sometimes I lead an author into a certain subject matter for their advice. But in your case, I don't like what I came up with, which was taking on overarching societal issues, which I think you do. But I don't know that you do that purposefully so much as you find that. So maybe that's not the place to go. But what advice might you have for writers who are listening?
Well, I think my advice actually is the best route to what you describe.
Okay.
Because the way I think about fiction is the dream life of the culture around us at a particular moment. It's an artifact, a narrative artifact of that collective dream life that acts through all creators, and ideally as much as possible. And my writing method is basically geared toward keeping me as open as possible to all of those outside forces and strains so that as much of that as possible can end up in my work. And the way that I do that, I think, is also a useful bit of advice for just how to get into the habit of writing and stay writing. And that is, be willing to write badly. I think we feel such a pressure to do things well, and also an aversion to discomfort. Discomfort is not necessarily bad, and it doesn't necessarily mean that anything is wrong. No one likes to write badly, but the difference between bad writing and good writing is so small compared to the difference between no writing and bad writing. So what I would say is, write often, write badly,
right,
and then revise.
Yeah.
And the one other thing I would say is, read at the level that you want to write and read the kind of material that you want to write. I'm very shocked at how often in a writing workshop, people start talking about television. I feel like, no, That's not what we're doing here. That is very worthy. And there are lots of people making a lot of money writing for television. But if your examples are television and what you want to do is watch television, write for television. If what you want to do is write, you know, literary fiction, you've got to inhale it, because none of us can do anything in a genre we're not reading. And I include myself. I was trying to write fiction in PowerPoint. I'd never really read many PowerPoints. It didn't work. I had to delve into a lot of really boring annual reports, let me tell you, before I became conversant enough in PowerPoint to make a meaningful contribution. Right now, all I'm reading is 1950s detective fiction, because if I want to make any kind of impact and enter that literary conversation, I had better know what already is out there.
All right. That's wonderful. Oh, fantastic. I want to mention again, the name of the novel is The Candy House. It's by my guest today, Jennifer Egan, and it's published by Scribner. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM. WBTV LP Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Jennifer Egan about her new book, The Candy House. You can learn more about her work at jenniferegan.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest, Jennifer Egan, an exercise that she assigns to her students, which she says has worked really well. Imagine yourself in a physical place, such as a room that you knew very well from an earlier point of your life. Describe what is to your left. What is to the right? Is there a drawer open? What's inside the drawer? Move through the space mentally, looking in every direction, looking out the window, and under the rugs. The second part of this prompt is to write about who comes into the room or space, and what do they do or say? Because physical spaces lead to people, and quickly. Jennifer says the real wonder of this is to see how much detail we retain, and it's also a way of defying the fragmentation of memory. If we imagine ourselves in a space, how much can we recall about tiny particulars of that place? And then, who comes in, and what are they moved to do there? Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I am not going to have time for the Bookworm's calendar this week, but I will bring it back next time. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors, if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, which is writethebook.podbean.com, where you can get all the archived episodes, and there are over 500 unique interviews there. New and recent episodes of Write the Book are available wherever you get your podcasts. You can just subscribe to have them sent to your app. A reminder to listeners who write, I do share a writing prompt each week. Often they have been suggested by my guests. So be sure to check the archives of Write the Book if you'd like to find any that you might have missed. You can also access the podcast and link to social media at my own website, which is shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please rate it where you find it and talk about it with people who might enjoy it. Up next at 5, stay tuned for Feminist Frenzy, the radio show with a feminist agenda. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.